So did everybody do the reading I signed in the email? I know Kathy said she did, but she's downstairs. So did anyone read the email?
I did read it.
Oh, yeah.
The Wikipedia article.
Okay, well, yeah, as I said in the email, we're talking about Ecclesiastes a little bit, amongst other things. So, yeah, if you got a chance to read it, that's great. If not, it's definitely worth reading. We'll read bits of it today. So if you've ever watched a commercial for, retirement options or an investment firm or a lottery or a car or a phone or a computer or even a fast food restaurant, you've probably noticed a constant theme. And it's usually some variation on the idea that if you just leave it to us, we will make your life simpler. If you invest with us, if you buy this car, this phone, eat at our restaurant, this will simplify your life. And it works because we seem to share this idea of the simple life. We have this, this dream that just around the corner is that easy life that we've been promised. I can remember when I was a teenager, I thought, if I could just find a girlfriend, that would make everything great and my life would be so simple. Because I'd always have a date on Friday night. I'd be cooler than all my friends without girlfriends. I'd have self-confidence because she would be so in love with me. But then, in my later teens and into my 20s, I had a few girlfriends. And then girl space friends. And it turned out that it wasn't quite as simple as I'd hoped it was going to be. Then I decided sometime in my 20s that what I really needed was a wife. And that would help. I would settle down. And then that way, if I were married, my job or, university and all that kind of stuff wouldn't be so bad because I'd have this wife to come home to at night. And it would be great. Because, it wouldn't really matter, if you had a shitty job or how much money you made, because you could just live off of love, right? I was convinced of this. I would never be lonely or depressed or angry because no one who's in love has anything to complain about, is what I believe. Then I got married, and it is great. it is great, and I do have a wonderful wife. But you quickly realize after you get married that just being married doesn't really solve all of these other problems. It doesn't make going to your bad job any easier. And you realize that that house that you thought would be so wonderful to come home to actually costs a lot of money to sort of keep up and maintain. And it is actually incredibly difficult to pay the rent with love. So it's awkward conversations with your landlord. You can imagine that if you'd like. So the funny thing is, you go through these steps. This is going to be simpler. So once I got married, I found that there were more steps. I had to finish school. Had to start a career, had to buy a house, buy a car, some RSPs, and of course a baby comes along, and it's time to buy a bigger house and a newer car and start a college fund. And you sort of go through all these things that you think, okay, I just got to get through this and this is going to be, then I'm going to be living an easy life. And at some point, the dust starts to settle a little bit. For me, that sort of came around January of this year, around the time that Addie turned one, because Jay and I had sort of this crazy year and a half to 2 years. I finished a graduate degree. I got a job. We moved 3 times in 1 year. Because we had a baby. We bought a house. We got a taste of what could generously be called home renovations. compared to what some people do, it's a long way. And during that time, we sort of tried to learn what it was to be parents. And so now, in the afterside of that year and a half to 2 years, we have sort of a more or less patterned life. It's somewhat predictable. We can sort of easily imagine the next few years, unless something crazy happens. On paper, we have more money coming in than going out, although it doesn't always feel like it. So when I think about it, I've got a good partner, a supportive family, a good church community, and a handful of close friends. So on paper, I am living the good life. I have reached the ideal. And yet, most of the time, I don't feel as great a sense of accomplishment or satisfaction. Because for some reason, I'm constantly driven to complicate my life. And maybe, I feel like this is probably common with people. And so, you know, when I sit back and life's calm, I start asking myself questions. All sorts of questions. I think, is the orange juice container recyclable? Because it's got that wax on it. What about the cap? Can I do that? If I'm taking multiple loads of trash out to the garbage, do I have to say hi to my neighbors every time I go to the garbage cans? Am I robbing Atticus of his anonymity by posting pictures of him on Facebook all the time? Does moving from an apartment building in a high-density area to a townhouse in a lower-density neighborhood mean that I'm adding to urban sprawl? Is everything that I do based on ideology rather than common sense? What is my carbon footprint? Why is it that after 400 years of being printed, newspapers still make my fingers black? How come they haven't figured that out? Is the fear of rejection that causes me to text friends rather than call them when I want to talk? Is it okay to grind coffee beans the night before, or should I really be doing that in the morning? Is it wrong to think less of people when I find out they buy things off of Amazon or shop at Walmart or own an e-reader? Now that I've offended everyone. Or do they deserve it because they are ignoring the damage they're doing to workers' rights, local economies, the book industry, and the environment? This is what I think about. Do I love Bruce Springsteen more than I love Jesus? I feel a lot of times that it's ridiculous that I own an iPad, even though I didn't pay for it. I also, every time I buy gas, I have this depressing thought that I'm actively burning money. Is it obnoxious to point out to suburbanites that their choice of neighborhood directly contributes to the potholes that they love to complain about? Is it stupid to feel ashamed that I've never read Ulysses by James Joyce, but I've seen every episode of How I Met Your Mother? And I don't even like How I Met Your Mother. If I believe that God created everything, and I believe that there is a hell, does that mean that I have to believe that God can't be entirely good? Because that would mean that at least some part of him wants an enormous amount of people to suffer. Why do I always read the comments section in news articles? Does it make me a bad Christian that the Bible is not my favorite book? Is my entire personality simply a reaction against what I don't want to be? Is artificial intelligence really as close as it seems?
No. As a computer programmer, I can
tell you. Thank you. That actually gives me some relief. What does it say about me as a human being that I was far more upset that my favorite movie theater closed last week than I am about the terrible things happening in Iraq right now? If there is a hell, how much worse could it really be than waiting in line in Tim Hortons? Because I can't imagine anything worse than Tim Hortons. So maybe you don't think about things like that, but these are the kinds of ideas that literally float around my head all day. Maybe I need a more exciting job. I don't know. So these are the reasons that Jane has stopped asking me. You know when you're like with your husband or wife and they say, what are you thinking about right now? Jane doesn't ask me that anymore. Yeah. Actually, you know what, last week...
Writing them down.
She did ask me last week. We were on a train, the Prairie Dog Central, and it was Father's Day, and Addie was sleeping, and she looked over because I was looking out the window, and she said, what are you thinking about right now?
And I thought it was something romantic, like, you know, I'm holding my son on a train, and yeah. How romantic is this? He wrote, Eric, he says, I'm thinking about that Buster Keaton movie, The General.
It's an old silent movie. It revolves around a steam train. We were on a steam train.
Here I was thinking that it is.
No, that's not what goes on. So this is what I think about. And I wonder, too, if I'm sometimes just creating problems for myself. I sometimes think that maybe I'm addicted to anxiety, that I need to be worried about something in order to feel like I'm doing something worthwhile with my life. But I don't know if that's necessarily the case. Because it seems to me that we as humans constantly indulge in the paradox that in our striving for simplicity, we create complexity. life would be much simpler if we never tried to build a career, buy a house, get married, have kids. If we just could somehow drift, wouldn't that be the simplest way to live?
Amen.
This is my father and mother here. You know, if we could... now I lost my place. If we could just work some sort of job that wasn't too painful, that we could pay the rent on a bare-bones apartment, we could simply keep to ourselves until we just drift into death. But I think the problems with this are kind of obvious, because you wind up with a lonely, pointless life. But again, what could be simpler than pointlessness? For some reason, human beings feel driven toward the very things that can create complexity in their life. And most of the time, it's because those things hold this promise of simplicity. Like I said, from the outside, my life looks very easy, and it is. So why do I feel anxious and depressed and angry and conflicted all the time? That might be something I should work out with a psychiatrist. But perhaps it's because there's something severely flawed about the concept of joy in simplicity. Perhaps the path of least resistance that we've been told that we should follow actually kind of leads off a cliff. The more I think about it, the more it becomes clear to me that human beings have no interest in simplicity. We keep buying smartphones because of the promise of a simple, seamless connection to the world around us. Yet, in reality, what they do is distract us from the work of becoming connected to ourselves. That's why you can't go to a department store or ride a bus or even go out for dinner without seeing everybody's nose lit up by their phones. We've become terrified by boredom. We're terrified of silence, and so we fill up our lives with noise. But really, what is simpler than silence? We willfully complicate in order to avoid simplicity. Actually, you know, it's funny that my dad said amen there, because he's a good example. And I'm not, this is not, my dad is retired. He's just had his 70th birthday. He was retired, and he decided that he wanted to keep working. So he just got a full-time job, because retirement's kind of boring, right? Yeah. I mean, how much 24-hour news can you watch? So there's a perfect example. You should be on your, what did you used to call it? Sunset?
Golden.
No, your sunset trail. Yeah. But here he is, back at work. So let's think about this idea of simplicity in another direction. Let's talk about religious fundamentalism for a minute, because that's always fun. Fundamentalism is an attempt to strip down a system of beliefs to its most basic idea in order to make it easy to understand and to follow. So let's just talk about Christian fundamentalism, because that's probably closest to the experience of most of us. And we're just going to do a simple, quick thing. So a fundamentalist reading of Christianity would say that if you believe in Jesus, you are going to heaven. If not, you are going to hell. That's the whole story. But then you start to be, you know, I think that the questions start to come pretty quickly. What does it actually mean to believe in Jesus? Well, you say this prayer and then you're in. If you don't, you go to hell when you die. Well, what if I say the prayer and then I shoot up a school and kill myself? Do I still go to heaven? Well, no, because you have to ask for forgiveness after each sin. So, because you killed yourself, you can't ask for forgiveness for that, so you're going to hell. Well, that doesn't really seem fair. What if I got in a car accident and I swore, and then I died when I go to hell? Well, swearing's a sin, so. So what if Hitler asked for forgiveness for the Holocaust just before his bunker got bombed? Would he have gone to heaven? What about people who live in remote villages who've never heard of Jesus or this prayer? Will they go to hell? Well, that's tougher to say. What about babies? My son can't speak yet. He hasn't said that prayer. If he dies, will he go to hell? Well, the Lord's ways are above ours. We can't understand his wisdom. So in an attempt to simplify theology, it leads to this enormous set of questions that can't be answered by the simplicity of the fundamentalism. So then we think about what happens when fundamentalist theology run into each other. We're into another fundamentalist theology. Look at all the conflicts between Jews and Muslims, or between Jews and Christians, or Christians and Muslims. How many human beings have been killed because one group went after another and said, this is the only truth, and we've got it? Simplicity of ideology leads directly to conflicts and to complications. It's easy to recognize, and yet we humans still chase after this dream of simplicity. There's this idea that there's pleasure, that there's this idea that in pleasure and in entertainment and in escapism and in simplicity, we'll somehow find fulfillment. And I know I get caught in these patterns. I think if I can just get through this day at work, and I'll be able to go home and just turn on the TV and tune out for a while. Or I think if I can just make it to the weekend, then life will be better. I'll have some time to self-actualize and readjust. I don't think this anymore, but if I can just get really drunk, I'll forget my problems and everything will look better. I learned my lesson on that one a long time ago. But not everyone has. And it's a really awful pattern that a lot of people get caught in, and in a search for simplicity and escapism. The letdown always is that when we get to these points, we find that in relaxation or in being entertained or in getting drunk, the joy that we find there is just as fleeting as the amount of time that we spend in it. But people become obsessed with the locations and the actions of relaxation. I'm sure everyone's talked to someone who could only ever talk about their cabin or fishing or partying or their garden or their next vacation. Or if you talk to me too often, it's probably whatever book I'm reading or movie I've seen or music I'm listening to. It gets a little boring because there's this obsession with the location or the action of relaxation that brings simplicity. And it's because we tend to disconnect our actual lives from the things that bring us joy. So pleasure becomes equated with leisure, and so we feel that joy can only be derived from the simplicity of leisure activities. So the actions of our everyday lives, eating with our families, commuting to work, working, cleaning and maintaining our homes, being in community, those become drudgery that has to be suffered through between bouts of leisure. And the problem is obvious. If the joy that lies in the simplicity of leisure is ultimately less gratifying than it seems from a distance, and if our everyday lives are just something we have to suffer through, then where does the joy exist? What is the purpose in the pursuit of pleasure? Well, we're not the first people to ask this. And that's why we're going to go to Ecclesiastes, because I come back to this book a lot, actually. I think it's sort of hidden in here, and it's not dealt with a lot, but it has just an incredible amount of wisdom. And I think I said in the email that I sometimes feel like if they re-edited the Bible, this would be the first to go, because it really doesn't fit with some of the happier stuff. But I'm going to read this. This is from King Solomon, who was said to be the wisest of all the kings. And it's under the heading, The Futility of Pleasure. I said to myself, come now, let's give pleasure a try. Let's look for the good things in life. But I found that this too was meaningless. It's silly to be laughing all the time, I said. What good does it do to seek only pleasure? After much thought, I decided to cheer myself with wine while seeking wisdom. I clutched at foolishness. In this way, I hope to experience the only happiness most people find during their brief life in this world. I also tried to find meaning in building huge homes for myself and by planting beautiful vineyards. I made gardens and parks, filling them with all kinds of fruit trees. I built reservoirs to collect the water, to irrigate my many flourishing groves. I bought slaves, both men and women, and others were born into my household. I owned great herds and flocks, more than any of the kings who lived in Jerusalem before me. I collected great sums of silver and gold, the treasure of many kings and provinces. I hired wonderful singers, both men and women, and had many beautiful concubines. I had everything a man could desire. So I became greater than any of the kings who ruled Jerusalem before me, and with it all I remained clear-eyed so that I could evaluate all of these things. Anything I wanted, I took. I did not restrain myself from joy. I even found great pleasure in hard work and additional rewards for all my labors. But as I looked at everything I had worked so hard to accomplish, It was all so meaningless. It was like chasing the wind. There was nothing really worthwhile anywhere. So here, you know, we have Solomon following this sort of tried and true adage. If you work and you accumulate and you procreate, you'll find joy at the end of your labors. But he doesn't. He finds meaninglessness. And he has this sort of, he's having this sort of Citizen Kane moment. I don't know if anyone's seen Citizen Kane. You really should. But it's this great movie from the 40s. This guy has everything, and he dies seeking the one thing that he can't get his hands on. It's not really a spoiler, but I don't feel like a 70-year-old movie I have to give a spoiler warning for. But anyway, you should check it out if you've never seen it. Solomon here is surrounded by everything that he has, but he still doesn't have the one thing he's looking for in life. He doesn't have meaning. He doesn't have joy. It's all empty. It's all chasing after the wind. Now, unlike Cain, Solomon doesn't die at this point. He goes on to figure a few more things out, which we're going to get to. But the question, you know, hangs over this section. Why doesn't Solomon find joy in accomplishment? Why is there no reward at the end of this road? This is what we're promised, right? Go to school, get a good job, have a family, and you will find satisfaction. And I think perhaps, maybe it's because life and perhaps relationships and faith and happiness are not actually an end. This isn't something that we're going for. We live in a culture, of narratives. And as any good first-year English student will tell you, a good narrative has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And the narrative is supposed to build to a satisfying conclusion. All of the elements are supposed to coalesce into a perfect state of resolution. And then your novel is a success. But anyone who's lived more than a few years can probably tell you that this is not obviously the way that life works. Life is cyclical. Things resolve and then get messy again. Marriages have seasons of struggle and seasons of peace. Jobs are sometimes fulfilling and sometimes insufferable. Children are sometimes a blessing, and sometimes they scream all night when you've got an important meeting the next day at work. Sometimes you can't wait to speak to your best friend, and sometimes it ruins your day just to see his or her number on your call display. But we rarely think about life as cyclical. And so we continue to strive for an ending. We continually create complexity in the hope that it will lead to simplicity one day, and then we will live happily ever after. But my 31 years of life have taught me anything. There really isn't this happily ever after. Not in this life. Instead, I think for me, and I think it's time to stop thinking about joy and happiness as something that's going to come later when the striving has ceased, but rather start thinking of it as something that's all around us all of the time and merely needs to be recognized and appreciated for as long as we're able to before some fear or setback or anxiety causes us to lose sight of it again. And I'm not saying that, I mentioned a few things before, that you shouldn't find joy in your cabin or vacations or children. But the problem becomes when we elevate certain places or experiences above others as the locus of our joy in our lives. We say, on the weekend, when I get to the Caribbean again, when I get married, when I have kids, when my mortgage is paid off, when I get that promotion, when my neighbor moves away, when my kids are adults and get jobs, when I get married again, when I retire, when I have grandkids, when I get that house, or that car, or that smartphone, then I will be happy. We find ourselves living in the then rather than the now. But the problem is that we will never actually live in the then. And if that is where our happiness is, then we can't really ever be happy. Because there'll always be a bigger house and a nicer car and better behaved kids and a larger RRSP, a more satisfying job, and a warmer climate. But there's no more joy or fulfillment in any of those things than you'll find in what you have right now. Because the only thing we discover upon gaining what we've been coveting is that having it is just as meaningless as having what we already own. And this is what Solomon is telling us. And he was on to something. And so he wrote this passage that is often, I think, mistaken for really depressing. But I find the more I've read it over the years and the more I've lived, the more I think it's actually quite profound and pretty beautiful. This is from Ecclesiastes chapter 9. He says, "So go ahead, eat your food and drink your wine with a happy heart, for God approves of this. Wear fine clothes and a dash of cologne. Live happily with the woman or man you love through all the meaningless days of your life. For that is what God has given you in this world. The wife or husband God gives you is your reward for all of your earthly toil. Whatever you do, do well. For when you go to the grave, there will be no work or planning or knowledge or wisdom." So as I said, sometimes people take this as kind of that's a bit of a downer. or they take it as do whatever you want, because it doesn't matter anyway. But I really think it's an attempt to remind us that joy is found in the here and now. It's found in our partner, our spouse, that we have. I think that's a really profound moment, because how easy it is to lose appreciation for your partner. Very easy. It's just amazing that joy is found in these meaningless moments, the mundane days that we have to move through to get to the ones that we think will be meaningful. Solomon goes on to say that all the worrying that we do at the hands of ambition or planning are equally futile. In verse 11, he says, "I have observed something else in this world of ours. The fastest runner doesn't always win the race, and the strongest warrior does not always win the battle. The wise are often poor, and the skillful are not necessarily wealthy. And those who are educated don't always lead successful lives. It is all decided by chance, by being at the right place at the right time." And so it's a reminder that, all of the, life planning and coaching and whatever else, sometimes it doesn't matter. And it's like it's a lot like what Jesus has to say about the lilies of the field or the birds. He tells us that worrying doesn't add one day to our lives. Which I think is repeated a lot, but when we really start to think about it, has a lot of depth to it. Now, I'm not telling you this because I have this all figured out. Sometimes, I remember when I was growing up in church and the pastor, I would thought, this guy is like a superhero because he's got, this is all the stuff he tells us, he's got everything worked out. Most of the time when I come and talk, it's because I'm trying to wrestle through whatever I'm talking about. And I need to spend some time with it. And my word processor becomes my confessor and psychiatrist all in one. But, yeah, so I wanted to talk about this because I'm actually terrible at this. I struggle when I go out to dinner not to sit there and add up the bill in my head. because I'm so thinking, okay, well, I could probably have another drink. The mortgage is next week. Sometimes when I watch Atticus play, I really have to stop myself from thinking about things like the cost of college in 20 years, or what the job prospects will be like when he's an adult, or if robots will be doing everything, which I'm assured will not be the case. I don't know. I start to think maybe the other kids at school are going to make fun of his name, or, I think, should we have another baby, considering the global overpopulation crisis? But every once in a while, I manage to turn off my brain and just appreciate the way his little mind is working as he figures out how to make his his tiny fingers manipulate that dial on his toy telephone so that it'll ring. And I'm able to take this enormous amount of joy sharing in his sense of accomplishment when he actually makes it work. Just this past weekend, Jane and I found ourselves downtown in the pouring rain after some dinner plans that we had gotten canceled. Or rather, actually got moved to the suburbs. And if there's anything you know about Jane and I, we will never move to the suburbs. So, hopefully. So we were sort of alone, just the two of us. We had a babysitter. And so we wandered over through the downpour to Rudy's, which is a great restaurant in the Hydro building. And we decided we would just sit on the patio and have a drink. And maybe it's because I was thinking about this so much. But while we were sitting there, I forced myself not to think about the bill for a second and to just look around me. It was still raining, but we were sort of protected under this canopy or roof or whatever that they have. And the smell of the rain was drifting towards us on the cool breeze that was blowing. The trees and the plants in the plaza were that vibrant shade of green that only seems to come after too much rain. There was a jazz quartet that was playing in the corner. Jane was looking particularly good in a summer dress. She's not here to hear me say that, so I'll say it. And I don't know, maybe it was the second shot of spiced rum in my drink, but just for a few moments I was sort of able to put some things behind me, forget that, you know, the Globe Theater had just shut down and the Bay's downtown store is a shadow of its former self, and that another war in Iraq seems inevitable. That Amazon is probably the worst American company since the Industrial Revolution, but people won't stop using it because it's cheap and easy. And I was able to just sort of take a deep breath and say, listen, Penner, just lighten up for a second. Because right now, your life is actually pretty great.